So we're at the sixth verse. Thus virtues are perpetually weak. The powers of misdeeds are terribly dreadful. Besides the wish for perfect enlightenment, what other virtue triumphs over them? So, we have many virtuous mind states. Basically, a virtuous mind state is one of wanting to do something that's going to be beneficial, not doing anything that's going to harm yourself or anyone else. Something that's motivated by the absence or the non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. But these are, because of our habituation to greed, to aversion, to delusion, it's very hard for us to actually do the misdeeds. And we constantly find ourselves in a position where we're either neutral or even worse. Something good happens to someone else and we start feeling envious of them or jealous. Why didn't this happen to me? It just naturally happens. Because we're so habituated to ego clinging and thinking about me and mine first, we want good for me and mine. We kind of forget about other people. And so when we see other people get good, we start feeling jealous and so forth. That's an example. We might have habits of feeling aversion, of feeling anger or so forth. And because our habits are so strong, then these misdeeds that come out of them are terribly dreadful. As it says, they're incredibly powerful. The virtues are perpetually weak. This is a little bit of an exaggeration, because virtues can be very strong. But what makes virtues strongest is if you have the motivation of bodhicitta. So besides the wish for perfect enlightenment, which is bodhicitta, the wish to achieve the state of Buddhahood for the state of others, what other virtues triumphs over them? So if we practice generosity, or if we meditate on loving kindness without any goal of doing it for achieving Buddhahood, then it's only going to be temporary. And the habituation of the misdeeds, because it doesn't overcome our ego clinging, because the habituation of misdeeds will then reassert itself, and we will again find ourselves experiencing suffering. So it's only bodhicitta, it's the only real antidote that can truly that can truly eliminate our suffering and our negative habits of mind that perpetuate suffering. So for that reason, there is no other virtue that triumphs over that. There's no other virtue that can really act as a remedy for the suffering of samsara. So the next so when we talk about it, the benefits of bodhicitta, there are many ways that the benefits are talked. There are those that we can see. There are those that we don't see. There are one of the benefits is that we can see that actually the Buddhas of the past have. Developing the bodhicitta, they've contemplated bodhicitta, and they've seen the great benefits that it brings. And so by seeing that the Buddhas find that there are qualities in it, we can also develop the qualities. So it has so we can see that it has the ability to protect ourselves from suffering, as it says in the first two lines of verse 7, the lords of sages who have contemplated for many eons see just this will help. So it is only bodhicitta that can really protect us from the sufferings of samsara, that can help overcome it. So it brings benefit to ourselves. But it also brings benefit to other sentient beings, because we can look and we see that the Buddha and great masters have meditated on bodhicitta, and they've developed the ability to help other sentient beings. So besides the wish, and this is because of the bodhicitta, so immeasurable multitudes of beings will gain through this the sublime bliss with ease. So it is only because beings such as the Buddhas develop bodhicitta and teach it to other beings that they're able to achieve that happiness themselves. Bodhicitta is also the basis for all of the different types of paths of that we can traverse as beings, whether we want to have a path to worldly happiness, a path to the happiness of liberation from samsara for ourselves, or the path to Buddhahood, it all depends upon bodhicitta. So as it says in verse 8, no one should ever forsake bodhicitta who wants to dispel beings and happiness, vanquish the hundreds miseries of existence, and partake in the many hundreds of joys. So, it's said that bodhicitta is the root of all of our happiness. It's the root not just of the happiness of Buddhahood that we will attain in the future, but also of all of our worldly happiness. They also depend on bodhicitta, because our happiness comes out of the virtues we've done in terms of karma, and that is increased, and it's protected by having bodhicitta. So therefore, bodhicitta is like the source, the mainstay of all of the happiness that we currently have. It's also the source of any happiness if we decide that we want to bring ourselves liberation from samsara and achieve something like the state of an arhat, which is like the result of the Hinayana, or the foundation vehicle path. This also comes from bodhicitta, because it comes from the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma. And the happiness of a complete enlightenment of a bodhisattva on the path, and the happiness of the complete enlightenment of a Buddha also comes from bodhicitta. So this is the happiness of those who want to dispel beings, but unhappiness. That's the Buddhas and bodhisattvas' joy. Vanquishing the hundreds of miseries of existence refers to achieving liberation for yourself, and partaking in the many hundreds of joys means achieving the pleasures of samsara, such as a comfortable existence in your next life. So it all depends on bodhicitta. So another benefit of bodhicitta is a visible benefit, and that's that you are then called a bodhisattva, that you then become a bodhisattva, you're recognized as a bodhicitta once you take the bodhisattva vow. As it says in verse 9, if they rouse bodhicitta in an instant, the wretched fettered in samsara's prison are named the offspring of the sugatas and revered in the worlds of gods and humans. So the moment that we develop the aspirational bodhicitta, take the bodhisattva vow, then it's like you've become a card-carrying bodhisattva. Now you are a bodhisattva, and so this and by making this commitment, you become someone who's worthy of respect by other people. Now, this doesn't mean that tomorrow you take the bodhisattva vow and you're going to go outside and people are going to worship your feet. I'm sorry, it doesn't quite work like that. There are stories in the sutras, though, about people who take the bodhisattva vow and then then many other people are inspired by and feel great faith. And you can actually also, I think you can understand how this has happened. You see someone who's making an incredible resolve and you rejoice and you feel good. Now, the traditional ancient Indian way of saying you feel good and you're rejoicing it is like to prostrate at someone's feet or to touch their feet or whatever. In our culture, we might not be doing this. It's like to give them a high five, something like that. People say, this is something that's really good, something that you really need to do, something that's that you celebrate other people doing this. You hear about people taking the bodhisattva vow, and it's like, really, oh, wonderful, they took the vow. It's excellent. This is something you celebrate. So by the moment you take that vow, people will say, there's something good that person has done. So you've become a bodhisattva. You've entered the path. That is the now. Once you really develop genuine bodhicitta, at that point you've entered the path of accumulation. You've entered the Mahayana path. You've entered the path to Buddha. And this is something that others can celebrate as well. So this is the benefit that it brings for us. The visible benefit it brings for us. So if they rouse bodhicitta in an instant, the wretched fettered in samsara's prison are named the offspring of the sugatas and revered in the gods of worlds of gods and humans. So really we are in a pretty wretched state before we have bodhicitta. There's no other hope to get out of this prison that we've created for ourselves, the prison of ego clinging. Bodhicitta is like, I guess bodhicitta is more than just, if compassion is the hammer that can open up the prison, then what is bodhicitta like? It's probably like, I don't know, maybe the tank that can bust it open. So that's the real benefit. Now, the next six, or actually the next five verses give what are called the six analogies for bodhicitta, to talk about what the qualities of bodhicitta. So the first of these is the example of alchemy. So alchemy is like when you take some inferior metal, you've got your special potion that you add to it, and it becomes gold. Lots of alchemists throughout the ages. So just like the greatest kind of alchemy, it takes this unclean body and transforms it into a Buddha's kaya, a precious jewel. So firmly grasp a hold of bodhicitta. So ordinary alchemy does something kind of mundane. I mean, I don't know if we talk about alchemy much anymore. People don't. But you take something, take ordinary iron, you put this little drop of your special alchemy liquid in it, it turns into gold, and everyone thinks it's great. And so this is, you know, it becomes something valuable. But the value of gold is limited. But similar, in one sense similar to that, what we can do is we can take the alchemy, the special sauce, was it? You know, the special sauce of bodhicitta, and we add it to ourselves. We take this unclean body of ourselves, because it looks like, okay, you took showers this morning. I'm not going to, most of you did, I'm sure. On the one hand, yes, we keep ourselves clean, but if we peel off the skin, it's pretty disgusting in there. You know, you're frankly filled with bile, blood, gore, poop, all sorts of stuff. You know, it's pretty disgusting in there. This body is inherently unclean. If you eat, you go to an expensive dinner, you get beautiful. You go to an expensive restaurant, you get a beautiful, clean dinner. It comes out on hygienic plates. Tomorrow morning, that hygienic food is no longer hygienic. And it has to be, you know, treated as wastewater in the wastewater treatment plant. So this body takes something clean and it turns it into filth. This is just the nature of the body. But it can be transformed into the body of a Buddha by this alchemy of bodhicitta. The next example is of the example of like a real jewel, something that we see as being of great value. So just like the, examined well by the sole leader of beings with his immeasurable mind, it has great value. So you who wish to leave the places of beings, firmly grasp hold of precious bodhicitta. So this example or this analogy is from like, you know, if you're going on a voyage someplace, and a group of travelers going on a voyage, you don't know where you're going, you don't know whether it's good to go, but there's the leader, the captain of the ship, who knows that if you go on this voyage, you'll get to the land of jewels, where there are lots of jewels scattered all over the beach. You can just pick them up, and you'll be wealthy after that. The captain knows the way and can show the way. Similarly, the soul leader of beings, the Buddha, has seen the way to Buddhahood that can bring us to the state of perfect happiness with his immeasurable mind. He sees that it has great value. So because there is someone we can trust, the Buddha, who has seen the value of it, we can also grasp hold of it and realize its value. The next analogy in verse 12 is about how bodhicitta continually gives benefits. It's not like other virtues. All other virtues, like banana trees, are spent once they have produced a result. The tree of bodhicitta constantly bears fruit, thus thriving inexhaustibly. So, the way karma works is that you do one action. Now, karmic cause and effect is very complicated, and they can have sort of subsidiary, secondary actions, but there's a main result that comes out of any one action. It's like one seed will grow one plant. One seed doesn't grow two plants, one seed grows one plant. So one karmic action will produce one ripened result. It may have effects on other things that we can call as other different types of results, but basically, you do a good action, it's going to have a good result in the future. You do a bad action, it's going to have a bad result in the future. Other actions, if you don't have the attitude of bodhicitta, those actions are only going to produce one good result. you're generous, and that's going to have a result of a feeling of prosperity or some experience of prosperity in the future. But if you have so they're like the banana tree. The banana tree grows, it gives off a shoot and all these bananas. You harvest the bananas, and then that stalk is done. It's never going to bear fruit again. But the bodhicitta is not like that. Bodhicitta will constantly bear fruit, like a wish-fulfilling tree. No matter what you want, it will come because of bodhicitta. So it constantly will bear fruit from now until you achieve the state of Buddhahood, and even beyond, it'll constantly bear fruit. So this is the example about the analogy about how the results of bodhicitta are inexhaustible. Now the next thing is, not only do we have good actions that produce happy results and bodhicitta increases those, we also have done bad actions in the past, and those will bring us bad results. And in fact, in our current society, most of us don't do anything that bad. But in past lives, we may well have done things that are quite bad. In fact, if you postulate an infinite number of previous lives, where you've probably done an infinite number of things, we've all done terrible things in past lives that we may not consciously remember in this life. So we have all this, baggage of misdeeds that's in our past. We need a way to overcome them. And the best way to overcome them is by bodhicitta. So the example is of like a hero who's escorting you through a dangerous spot. So like those who in great danger rely on heroes, why would the careful not rely on that which liberates them in a single instant, even if they have done horrendous wrongs? So in old days in India, there were a lot of bandits. So if you're going to go traveling, if a group of merchants were going to go traveling, they would bring heroes, big knights in shining armor, I guess, to use the medieval. They'd bring heroes, swordsmen and militiamen, or they'd bring bodyguards along to protect them from when the bandits would attack. So when you're going through that dangerous place, you have to have your bodyguard. So we're going through the dangerous straits of samsara, and we need to have protection as well. And that best protection comes from bodhicitta, the wish for enlightenment. And it can overcome even horrendous wrongs. For example, there's the story of Milarepa. He'd killed 36 people in one go by casting sorcery, and felt terrible remorse about that. But he developed bodhicitta. He developed the wish to achieve the realization of Mahamudra and achieved Buddhahood in a single lifetime. So it can overcome. So even if you are a mass murderer, there's also the story of Angulimala in the sutras, who killed 999 people, met the Buddha, felt regret, and was able to become an arhat. So the horrendous wrongs we have done in the past can be overcome by bodhicitta. So this we have two verses here that are speaking about overcoming this over our misdeeds. So this verse is speaking about overcoming the misdeeds that are definitely going to ripen upon us. But there are many misdeeds that we're not sure when they're going to ripen or not. And so the next two lines speak about these. It says, just like the inferno at an age's end, it burns up great misdeeds in a single instant. So according to the traditional cosmology of Buddhism, at the end of the eon, the sun or the whole earth is going to be destroyed by fire. So we can, similar to our current scientific understanding of the solar system, at some point the sun is going to expand and this earth is toast. Everything's just going to be burnt. Nothing will be left, essentially. So similarly, bodhicitta has the power to eliminate all of the misdeeds that, just hanging out there in our karmic baggage. So those are the first five examples. And then the sixth, they call this the sixth analogy, but this isn't really an analogy. It's actually saying this is the sixth this is someplace you can look for more analogies. Its untold benefits were enumerated to Sudana by the protector Maitreya. There is a sutra in which Maitreya gave 200 and taught 250 benefits of bodhicitta, and so these are mentioned in the commentary by Pao Sulat Trengwa, but we haven't time, so I will not go through them all. So these are the benefits of bodhicitta. Well, when you talk about bodhicitta, is the how many, you know, what sort of types of bodhicitta are? Last night we talked a little bit about relative and ultimate bodhicitta. So if relative bodhicitta is the wish to achieve enlightenment, are there different types of relative bodhicitta? That's what the next couple of verses talk about. It says, to summarize, it's understood there are two types of bodhicitta, the mind aspiring for awakening and the engagement in awakening. So we've got two different types of bodhicitta, basically. When we talk about the wish to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings, there's aspirational bodhicitta, which means just having the wish. I want to achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings. And then the second type is the engaged bodhicitta, which means not just having the wish, but actually engaging in the practice of bodhisattva, practicing the path of the six paramitas. So these are the two types of bodhicitta, aspirational bodhicitta and engaged bodhicitta. So the difference of these two, as they discussed in the next next verse, it says, just as they know the difference between the wish to go and going, the wise should understand the contrast between these two respectively. So like, aspirational bodhicitta is like, I want to go to Trungpa Rinpoche's teaching in Bodhanath next March with everyone else from Maine who's going to these trips. It's the advertisement portion. It's my product placement for the day. That's the wish. Then actually doing the things to go, buying your ticket, getting to the airport, getting on the airplane, that's like actually going, right? So aspirational bodhicitta is where you say, I'm going to do this. I want to do it. I really want to become a Buddha to help sentient beings. But you haven't yet actually started doing it. This is an incredibly good thing to do. You shouldn't think that this is some sort of minor thing. It's not defective. It's not a problem to have aspirational bodhicitta. It's 100% positive. It's an extremely good thing. But it's not quite like engaged bodhicitta. Engaged bodhicitta means actually doing the practice of generosity, practicing discipline, which means having an ethical approach to life, taking and keeping vows, practicing patience instead of getting angry, being diligent, that is avoiding laziness, practicing dhyana, having meditative stability, and developing prajna. So these are the, actually engaging in those practices is the path of engaged bodhicitta. And that has greater results than the aspirational bodhicitta. So aspirational bodhicitta is good, engaged bodhicitta is better. Now, when we talk about engaged bodhicitta, one thing I want to talk about here is we hear a lot of talk about engaged Buddhism in contemporary society. People, you know, Buddhists going out and doing social good, this is wonderful. It's an important thing to do. What's going to make it really engaged bodhicitta and engaged Buddhism and engaged bodhicitta is if you also do these acts of helping people in the community with an attitude of bodhicitta. Not forgetting that attitude. It's not like going out, I'm going to be an engaged Buddhist, so I'm going to help in the soup kitchen or whatever. I'm going to help in the center. I'm going to help with these refugees or whatever. It's not just that. Doing that is good. But then when you go out and you do that and you say, by making a connection, see, here I'm going, I'm making a connection with whoever, let's say refugee family. You make a connection with a refugee family, you do something to benefit that refugee family. If at the same time you have in yourself the internal motivation by making this connection to this refugee family or whoever it is you're helping, by making this connection, may they achieve Buddhahood. by any merit that I have done, may they and all other sentient beings achieve Buddhahood. If you have that attitude internally, then that's engaged bodhicitta as well as engaged Buddhism. So if you're going to practice engaged Buddhism, very good. And engaged bodhicitta is even better, right? So that's kind of a little bit of an aside. What's most important is your attitude. And you don't need to go and say to your refugee family, I'm doing this out of a motivation of bodhicitta. No. Internal motivation. Best to always hide your qualities as much as you can, better. So bodhicitta has great results. Even in samsara, great results come from aspiring bodhicitta. But unlike engaged bodhicitta, the merit is not continuous. So when you do, when you have the aspirational bodhicitta, it's incredible merit. It does bring you great good in this lifetime because it's really like training your mind in a positive way. And the more you train your mind in a positive way, the more positive things are going to appear to you. Even when bad things happen, you'll be able to handle them more because your mind will be trained in the most positive way it could be. That sense of loving kindness and compassion, you have that incredible positive reservoir that will help you really do well in this lifetime. And then maybe things will work out. But unlike engaged bodhicitta, the merit is not continuous. So as it continues, but from the moment when for the sake of freeing beings in infinite realms you truly take up this intent with irreversible resolve, from that time on the many powers of merit flow forth unremitting in torrents equal to the sky, even when you're asleep or careless. So once you begin in doing the engaged bodhicitta, so you practice generosity with the motivation of bodhicitta. You keep the discipline of the bodhisattva vow, which means giving up harming sentient beings and practicing and doing what you can to bring sentient beings to Buddhahood, to benefit them in all ways, temporary and permanent. From that time on, you make that resolve to engage in the engaged bodhicitta, then you reap the results continuously. It's like you're continuously training your mind in positive energy and transforming yourself by gathering the accumulation of merit. And so this is something that Shantideva made up himself. The Tathagata himself explained this and its reasons for the sake of beings inclined to the foundation and the sutra requested by Subahu. So there are some beings who don't have the courage at this point to take the bodhisattva vow, to make the commitment of a bodhisattva, and they're more inclined to following the path of the foundation vehicle, such as the Theravada teachings, where you strive to achieve liberation and nirvana for yourself, not necessarily for others. And so the Buddha explained the reasons why bodhicitta is a superior source of merit to these people in the sutra requested by Subahu. So the way it was taught is a story. It's mentioned in the next two stanzas. If someone who benevolently intends to merely eliminate sharp pains in sentient beings' heads possesses immeasurable merit, what need to speak of those who wish to rid all sentient beings of untold distresses and endow each one with boundless qualities? So the story is, there was a merchant named Maitreya who and his wife were trying to have a child, and they had several sons, but they all died when they were infants. They were very distressed at this, and finally the wife got pregnant again. She gave birth. It was a son. They were overjoyed, but then they were terrified. What's going to happen? So they named the son Daughter. He came to be known Maitreya's Daughter. So Maitreya's Daughter, Maitreya went off on a ship. He was a sea captain. He went. One of the things that they did in ancient India is they went on sea trips to go collect jewels and riches from various islands in the Indian Ocean. So he went on one of these trips, and the ship was wrecked, and he was killed. He didn't come back. So In India, of course, the children do whatever the father did. The sons do whatever did the father did. That's their job. So Maitreya's daughter was trying to figure out, what am I going to do in my life? And his mother would not tell him, because she was deathly afraid that he'd go off and become a merchant captain and go off on a get wrecked in a ship, and she'd never see him again. So he went out and he did a few things, earned some money. He earned 8 gold coins. He gave them to his mother. He went out. He asked, please tell me what father did so I know what I'm supposed to do with my life. She wouldn't tell him. He went out. He earned more money somehow, and he came back with 16 gold coins and gave them to his mother and said, please, please tell me what father did. Won't tell you. Went out, earned 32 gold coins, came back, dutifully gave them to mom. Still wouldn't tell him. Then some of his friends told him, your father was a sea captain. You should go out to sea and lead a crew of merchants out to sea and come back with fabulous riches. Then he knew, this is what I have to do with my life. So he went back home and said, Mom, I'm going to go get me a ship, go out on a ship captain. She said, no, you can't go. And she tried to stop him from going. He knocked her down and he kicked her in the head. He stomped out the door, went off and got a ship. They went out to sea. Big storm came up. Ship was wrecked. He clung to a piece of wood and found himself washed up on the side of an ocean. On the shore of an island, it's a deserted island beach. He gets up and he comes along. He walks in. He comes to this fantastic city where there are 8 beautiful maidens who say, come in. Just don't go south. Come and enjoy. They feted him. They treated him very well. But don't go south of here. And he stayed there for a while, but he started to get a little bit bored. He traveled south. He left. He went south, and he came to another big, beautiful city. And there were 16 maidens waiting for him. Treated him very well. But don't you go south. Well, of course he went south, and he came to the city where there were the 32 maidens who treated him beautifully, feted him, everything that you could possibly do for him. Don't go south. Well, what does he do? He goes south. He comes south, and he gets to a big, iron, black, gray city, and he hears someone screaming, so he goes to look, what is it? And he comes to this tower, and inside the tower, there is this room where there's this guy who has this huge screw that's screwing into his head and boring his brains out. And this, and Maitreya's daughter says to him, what happened to you? And he said, I've been in hell for ages. I kicked my mother in the head, and I won't be freed until the next person who's kicked his mother in the head comes. And then the big contraption comes off, and it comes and it pucks under that, and he feels this incredible pain as this metal thing screws into his head. The other person dies and is reborn, and he feels the incredible pain of this hellish pain of this, and he has this terrible feeling, and he thinks at that point, if by me experiencing this, may no being ever experience such pain again. And at that moment, the machine flies off his head, he's released, and he is then reborn in the divine realms. By experiencing that single wishing to eliminate bad headaches, migraines, more than a migraine, okay, that sharp screw them, by having that wish to eliminate that he then was freed from that suffering. What need to speak is there to speak of bodhicitta, which is not just, we're not just saying, okay, people who get their heads caught in these contraptions, may they be freed from suffering. We are talking about everyone, all sentient beings, all types of suffering. So this is the great types of bodhicitta. And I think what we will do is we will maybe take a little bit of time for questions or doubts at this point.